FCC's broadcast division. The connection was this. Porter was FCC chair from December 1944 to February 1946, when Benton was pursuing his subscription radio plan, which needed permission basically from the FCC. And Plotkin helped to draft the FCC's Blue Book, which was a set of guidelines that, among other things, tried to ensure that broadcasters were operating in the public interest. The point was that all three men shared a history and an interest in public service programming and in an alternative to the commercial model of broadcasting. The bulletin also called into question Benton's credentials. The bulletin reminds us that Benton's ascension to the Senate was thanks to Chester Bowles, his old ad agency partner. Chester Bowles was governor of Connecticut when he tapped Benton to fill a vacated Senate seat. So they're basically trying to say that he wasn't at all equipped to do what he was doing. The bulletin all but calls Benton a hypocrite, doubting the sincerity of Benton's disapproval of radio's commercialism because Benton was, quote, sitting on a 20-sponsor wallet instead of a pillow. Bottom line, the NARTB was accusing Benton of corruption. Since Benton was a proponent of subscription television for the purposes of improving the educational function of television, because his old friends in the FCC were allegedly instrumental in the drafting of the bill, because Benton was a major shareholder in Muzak, and finally because S-1579 offered a path to a subscription model, the NARTB cried foul. This NARTB bulletin was part of what Paul Porter called a smear campaign. In a scathing letter to Harold Fellows, president of the NARTB, Porter called the NARTB's actions reprehensible and asserted that the association's failure to address criticisms leveled at the industry, quote, may invite really unpalatable remedies, a threat if there ever was one. He wrote, serious proposals by responsible people should not be met by slick innuendos or vilification, nor should this vital question of public policy be obscured by unwarranted charges of censorship. Shortly thereafter, Benton wrote to Justin Miller, former president of the NARTB, expressing his amazement at the short-sightedness of the article. He wrote, I cannot comprehend it. I know a lot about trade associations, and I know how short-sighted many of them tend to be in their efforts to appeal to the emotions and prejudices of their members, but you're in a field where leadership and long-range viewpoint is essential to the ultimate prosperity of the industry. The NARTB's statements about Benton's alleged financial motives were so stinging that Senator Benton wrote to the bill's co-sponsors to assure them that he did not seek profit from his support of educational and subscription television. He relayed the details of a phone call that he had had with Harold Fellows, the president of the NARTB, in which Fellows said that the NARTB, quote, had no intention of implying that he had had a personal financial stake in these issues. Shortly after the offending bulletin was sent to NARTB members, the NARTB television board met in Virginia to deal with, among other things, the Benton bill. At that meeting, the television board adopted a resolution opposing the bill and authorizing the NARTB to, quote, protect the American system of television broadcasting and freedom of expression. American here clearly meant commercial, though NARTB rhetoric framed the bill and resolution as threats to free speech. Board directors characterized the CAB as being, quote, one step away from being an actual censorship agency. One line in the trade article reporting about this meeting is particularly telling. After reporting on the board's concerns about subscription TV and educational TV, the article states, obviously the board felt it should set the pace for a determined battle against legislation deemed highly damaging to the private telecasting industry. Gone was the pretense of doing battle against legislation that encroached on freedom of expression. Even an earlier line in the article points to the facade. Referring to the board's double-barreled attack on Benton, the article refers to the first shot as the adoption of explosive resolution condemning the Benton measures and calling them threats to freedom of speech. So the plan to label the resolution and bill a threat to freedom while strategizing about the actual threats, subscription TV and educational TV, was truly the best way to win this fight. Pro-democracy rhetoric in the thick of the Cold War. So I've written elsewhere about the NARTB's fierce anti-government rhetoric, and there's far too much of that to go into here, but I will summarize their main arguments. The U.S. is capitalist. The U.S. is a democracy. So commercial television is inherently democratic. Censorship is fascist. Anti-communist or anti-capitalist forces are communist. So Benton and the FCC are fascists and communists. I am not exaggerating. All right, this is exactly what they were saying. In terms of reactions, Broadcasting, a trade magazine created by the NAB that operated as a mouthpiece for the association, predictably criticized Benton's initiatives. Other reactions ranged from measured to supportive. Frank Stanton at CBS wasn't happy with the bill, but he didn't cry censorship. He just questioned the role of the CAB, given the regulatory powers that the FCC already had. An NARTV member service bulletin reported that most FCC commissioners were actually against the bill, but Chairman Wayne Coy and Paul Walker dissented. Along with Coy and Walker, the ACLU was an important ally. Regardless of the revisions and clarifications made to the bill, Benton wrote to the ACLU in October 51 saying, well, the NARTB still wants to argue that the CAB represents censorship. But the ACLU, for its part, had already issued a statement a week before supporting both the bill and the CAB. The statement read, quote, the ACLU is ever vigilant to any threat of censorship, and we would be the first to register our opposition to this measure if we believed that censorship control over programs was the motive behind the bill. The motive they understood was the creation and maintenance of educational television stations. And the ACLU further praised a section of the bill that said that the CAB would investigate instances of commercial censorship. Right? Meanwhile, while all this is going on with Benton, and the bill, the newly constituted TV board of the NARTB met for the very first time on June 4th, 1951. By June 11th, the TV board was reviewing programming logs the television stations had sent in so that they could review kind of programming trends. By June 22nd, the committee held a day-long session to discuss the state of TV programming with both FCC Chair Wayne Coy and Senator Edwin Johnson in attendance. Johnson was a big friend of the industry. At that meeting, Paul Rayburn of Paramount Television Productions warned, quote, I would advise that we take to self-regulation immediately. The experience in the motion picture industry has been that if political censorship gets into the picture, it's impossible to get out. Senator Johnson, whose committee oversaw the hearings into the Benton bill, assured NARTB members that censorship was not looming. He mentioned Benton by name, questioning his ability to present solutions related to education, so he was very, very anti-Benton. The result of that meeting was a resolution to draft standards in order to, quote, improve the character of television programming and ensure its observance of good taste. That draft eventually became the Television Code, which was accepted by the NARTB membership in October 1951 and officially implemented in March 1952. Nothing happened when the 82nd Congress adjourned in October 1951, though Benton did address senators and cautioned them to be wary of, quote, pressures they may be subjected to from broadcasters upon their return to their home states. Sure enough, the November 12th NARTB bulletin called on its members to, quote, take advantage of your national legislators being home during the congressional research. Make it your personal responsibility to discuss the issue with these gentlemen and give them the broadcaster's viewpoint. Meanwhile, the Benton bill was languishing. The NARTB had requested to testify. Senator Ernest McFarland wrote to the NARTB back in September, assuring them that they would be heard, but also suggesting that since Congress was adjourning in October, hearings might not be held until 1952. A letter from Justin Miller to a station manager in March 1952 assured the recipient that all was quiet on the Hill, basically that it was just a matter of waiting for the session to end. And this is how it ended. This is an NARTB scoreboard in which they would send to their members what challenges were, what the NARTB's position was on these challenges, and what the outcome was. And this was their, how they dealt with Benton. So the challenge was the Benton bill and what they called censorship measures, their position, and then the outcome. The Benton bill expired with the 82nd Congress. Sure enough, Benton wasn't reelected in 1952, so that effectively ended any talk of the CAB. A short piece in the New York Times in October 1951 raised an important point about the CAB that the NARTB never latched onto. Supporting the NARTB's right to oppose the advisory board, the article stated, quote, the idea of having a panel of citizens sit in judgment on a mass media is very old. and almost a stock remedy among well-intentioned reforms. It goes on to state that an advisory board created by legislation can no longer merely be an advisory board. It wrote, it obviously has a quasi-official status not enjoyed by a private group. So this calls into question the selection process. Who gets to be on this board? And how much power would they actually have? Of the bill, the article concludes, quote, the aims are so appealing that it's easy to overlook the unsound principle upon which the measure rests. The problem that the article points to, the quasi-official status not enjoyed by a private group, is precisely the problem with the NARTB. All right, as a self-regulatory body with such a tight relationship with the FCC, to the extent that the FCC adopted NAB and NARTB standards, the NARTB, especially in adopting the television code, has been accused of acting with the blessing of the state. And if the tenets of the television code were supported by, facilitated by, or otherwise encouraged by the FCC, then it could have been a very real case of censorship. The NARTB's swift drafting, approval, and adoption of the television code left Benton completely kind of unable to digest this huge public relations strategy. In a letter to Wayne Coy, who's chairman of the FCC, he wrote that the code set impossible goals for television. He wrote, quote, anyone interested in censorship could make a much stronger case for censorship against this television code than possibly could be made against the CAB. The ACLU agreed, calling the code stifling and illegal censorship, and in response, Justin Miller, former president of the NARTB, called the ACLU, quote, a bunch of sneaking hypocrites. The same day Benton wrote to Wayne Coy, he sent another letter to an associate, correctly predicting the outcome of the entire issue. He wrote, the danger of this code is, of course, that Congress will be glad to accept the protestations of the industry as embodied in this code as the kind of excuse politicians seek to avoid facing up to a hot and difficult issue, an issue which promises few political rewards and many political hazards. It may not seem like a big deal, all right? The battle over different models of television, the quest for a concrete application of the public interest, the codification of self-censorship in an industry that had been censored by sponsors for so long. But all of this emerges at a high point of tension in the burgeoning television industry. Commercial television broadcasting was set to explode in 1948 after being postponed by World War II. And then all of a sudden, the FCC realized it screwed up. It needed to fix its channel allocation. So things stopped again. All right, not everything stopped. Network shows got on the air, people were buying television sets, there were 107 stations by 1952, I Love Lucy became a big hit. But most of the country didn't have access to television. This is NBC's affiliate coverage in 1952. NBC had the most affiliates of all four networks. So much of the country does not have a station. Each little dot represents a station. The solid lines represent interconnection. A state like California, only three stations. Texas, only three stations. South Texas, where I'm from, no TV at all. 1952. So a lot of different, I mean, there were four different networks. They all had affiliates, but the same parts of the country in all of these maps that you look at were empty, all right? Once the freeze was lifted, television stations, network affiliates could expand to all these areas, and the big money from advertising would start to roll in. The NAB, foreseeing this, killed the TBA and swallowed TV. Intent on avoiding what they considered to be the mistakes of early radio, the NAB and then the NARTB fought tooth and nail to disallow a viable nonprofit and or non-commercial paradigm to emerge, a paradigm that might have housed different ideas about what television could be. By 1958, over 80% of U.S. homes had television sets. Benton knew that if something didn't happen before 1952, it wasn't going to happen at all. The threat of reform forced the industry to look for a quick fix, so the NARTB sacrificed the creative side of its trade to save the commercial side, rewarding the strangling of stories, genres, and aesthetics with a seal of good practice. Thank you.
Questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Questions.
Questions.
I
I've got a question that might be a little bit off target, but I'm interested in this idea of subscription radio and what the technology of that would have been.
Well, the reason that the FCC was involved with that is because, and if you know more about this, please let me know. They had to actually reserve channels for subscription radio. So it was called pig squeal radio, because if you weren't a subscriber, you would just hear what sounded like a pig squeal. So they did need to reserve over the air channels for subscription.
And the people with the radios would have had some decoder that would have...
Yeah, basically there would have been, like, I know with TV it was like a set-top box.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really found much about subscription radio in my work so far, but I know there were, like, different, you know... It's somehow analogous to satellite.
Yeah, there are different mechanisms. I know for television you would have a set-top box where you would insert coins, and, you know, that was experimented with since the 1930s, actually. So with radio, it would have been something very similar.
There was some punch card type
thing. There was a punch card, yeah. And I don't know if you all remember with early satellite, there was also a punch card involved. So the models weren't entirely different.
Before my time. So I have a question. Was there any connection between, and maybe, I don't know if it's personnel or just ideas, between the motion picture code and the television code in terms of conversations that people had, or...
Right. So the Hollywood Production Code was around since 1930. It wasn't really enforced until 1934. That was coming mostly from pressure from Catholics, right? So the Catholic Legion of Decency, you know, they were basically telling Catholics all over the U.S. that, you know, if they saw these particular films... they would be, you know, damned for all eternity, that kind of thing. So, the Catholics represented, a significant, share of the audience. And so that was also a PR move, you know, not wanting to offend anyone. And I was telling this to Ben earlier, that the Hollywood Production Code is much more moralistic. Mm-hmm. It has the word God in it over, like, a dozen times. And so the television code used the production code as inspiration, but also used earlier radio codes and NBC's own continuity acceptance department standards. It didn't use God kind of all the time. Mm-hmm. It was a later document. It was more of its time. It was really geared towards, you know, protecting children. All right, but the conversations kind of necessarily had to be different because television was coming into your home whether you wanted to or not, right? Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, in all of this rhetoric, in TBA rhetoric and NAB rhetoric, it's all about being a welcome guest in people's homes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But was religion or religious pressure a factor at all in
it
the
was,
TV codes?
It was to an extent. You can sense the religious pressure when you're reading it, but they did have specific provisions like banning astrology, for instance. You couldn't have astrology or fortune telling on television. You couldn't have it on radio either. In the 1948 radio code that was there.
That was kind of the last thing I was expecting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Was
that like a new thing? Astrology
yeah.
was all
yeah.
over the place, and
yeah.
they were like, oh, it doesn't sound
well,
like
the thing
that.
Was...
So, like, organized religion, it doesn't sound like...
No, I mean, the thing was that astrology in... because it was very big in Canada, actually, astrological programs. In speaking to an audience that was home during the day... meaning unemployed, uneducated, or women, astrological programs were, they represented a kind of a threat to the authority of organized religion, right? So in that way, you know, the code was trying to tamp that down, to marginalize alternative ideas, and to also ensure a taste level that the networks aspired to. So programs like roller derby, programs like astrological programs, there was one in particular that was very popular in LA. Carol Ryder was the astrologer. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was Ronald Reagan's astrologer. He was the astrologer to the stars in California. He was a very, very big name. He had a show. He had a television show.
Of the stars and
exactly.
In the stars. Of the stars.
Exactly. He had a very popular television show in L.A., and because of the code, you know, stations were afraid to carry it, but also networks wanted to, especially NBC, wanted to make sure that they were reaching a certain class of viewer. So no roller derby, no astrology. But the astrology angle, that's where, you know, religion, you know, really kind of places its stamp. I guess organized religion places its stamp on the code. But also there are underlying, you know, morality issues and these kinds of, the sanctity of marriage and, you know,
low cut dresses cause all the sex occurrence.
Exactly.
All of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So what was, within the networks, within the creative producer angle of the networks, how did they protest? Was there any protest?
I mean, the thing is that NBC had had its own censorship department, a very organized self-censorship department since 1934. And their documents are all at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and they're fascinating. So their censor was named Stockton Helfrich. And he would weekly send reports out to the executives detailing everything that was eliminated from scripts, everything that was changed, not only from scripts, but how blocking was changed, how actors needed to be rearranged. You couldn't, like, there's this one that I show in my 303 class, you know, a woman coming out of a room adjusting her dress. Okay, that couldn't happen, right? Because that implied that she had just gotten lucky. So,
or she had static. I mean, I don't know. There's all kinds of explanations for that.
So, I mean, this was definitely accepted practice.
If you wanted a job, you just had to buy in.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically that's what it was. And, you know, I mean, the thing is that with the Hollywood Production Code, their enforcement mechanism was the seal. And because the studios were vertically integrated, if you wanted to get your movie shown in a first-run theater, which were the best theaters, you had to pass the administration and get the seal. With this seal, the thing was, it was completely voluntary because the NARTB didn't want to be busted for antitrust, right? They didn't, the stations didn't want to be seen as colluding unfairly on a set of standards. So this was all voluntary. And, you know, some people argue, because the code was revised multiple times until it died in, like, 81. Yeah. And you know, standards were relaxed and some things were tightened and, but, you know, they'll say, well, you know, stations didn't really care necessarily. As the years went on, they weren't all subscribing to the code. Because just because you were an NARTB member doesn't mean that you subscribe to the code. This was just a way of demonstrating to viewers that they cared. And it was also a way of demonstrating to the FCC that they deserved to keep their licenses. Mm. Right?
So you could be a local television affiliate and show something not...
I mean, if, you know,
under the code.
Yeah, I mean, you had your own airtime to fill, right? Because networks don't program for 24 hours a day. So conceivably, they could have shown something that didn't align with code standards. However, that's when viewers write into the FCC.
Right.
And those complaints go into your file.
So they protected themselves on both sides. They protected themselves from being called a censorship kind of organization or being affiliated with the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they protected themselves against the people's protest at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Stark censorship.
Yeah, and because the networks want 100% clearance, they want their shows on every station in the country, you know, that's where lowest common denominator comes in, but that's also where these issues of decency come into play. Like, you know, it has to play in Peoria, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and as a writer... I mean, it's interesting to get your take on this. And this is what I tell my students, that, you know, for those of you who want to go on to be writers, I mean, try to imagine how you would craft a dynamic, sophisticated, really interesting show using kind of these constraints. And that's not to say that these shows didn't, you know, there wasn't originality, there wasn't creativity, but this very much explains why the broadcast networks are still, you know, overloaded with cop shows, right? Mm-hmm. Cops, docs, and lawyers. But it's cable that can branch out into these anti-heroes and get all the critical acclaim.
Mm-hmm. And what's so cool is that when you look at the nascent television industries in, let's say, Middle Eastern countries, because I just did a chapter in a larger work about the Iranian film industry,
mm-hmm.
the censorship that's going on now, post-revolution, is so, so similar
mm-hmm.
to what was going on between the 30s and the 50s. And the
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Brie?
This is probably left field, but, like, looking at the Benton bill of the 11 volunteers, I guess, does it have any precursor to the MPAA and how, like, that was set up? And how, like, because I believe it's a group of volunteers who, like, rate films on whether or not...
Yeah, well, the MPAA was the outgrowth of, what was it, the MPPDA, right, the Motion Pictures Producers Distributors of America. So I don't think that they're kind of directly related, but I think they're of the same vein, right? They're, you know, this idea of a censorship board. But, you know, prior to the MPAA, I think prior to, maybe a little bit beyond the Miracle decision in the early 50s that you know, gave films, or that protected films under the First Amendment, states had their own censorship boards, right? So it was definitely a state-by-state process. So this wasn't new, kind of, by any means. But it was intensely scary to the television industry, but not as scary as the decentering of the commercial model. Like, that was the thing. But it was easiest to kind of cling to the censorship thing. And the NAB had been doing it for a while. When the FCC came out with its blue book, it was basically destroyed by the rhetoric of the NAB. They were, you know, again, calling them every name in the book because they saw it as a threat to their commercial freedoms, essentially. Yeah. Hero.
Have you looked at it in terms of the year? I mean, 1952 is kind of the end, the unofficial end of, like, the New Deal, and you have two generations of government officials who have worked through the Progressive Era and then New Deal politics, and how, you know, this idea of regulation changes at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any connections that you found with any of the senators to that background, or where they're coming from at all?
That's a really, really good question. This is my first push into the Congress chapter, so I haven't actually been able to delve into that, but that's definitely something to take into account. Up until this point, I've been writing specifically about the NAB and the TBA and the FCC a little bit, so I'm just now kind of getting into this whole narrative of actually what's going on in Congress, what have they been dealing with, you know, how are their careers kind of informing what they're doing. But because Benton was a newbie, I think this is also an interesting thing. I mean, he was corporate liberal, so, you know, he was coming from kind of that tradition, understanding kind of how to meld all these disparate forces. But, you know, he wasn't a career politician. He filled a vacated seat, and then he did run successfully, but then he was out of there. So, you know, it makes you wonder if his kind of newness to the process set him apart in any ways. Right, exactly. Exactly. So, no, but that's a really good question.
Deborah, you know, hearing you mention sort of distinctions between Canadian and U.S. programming, and then, you know, that in LA, they, which isn't surprising, that
yeah.
astrological
exactly.
programming made me wonder if you can talk at all about regional distinctions in this process of deciding, you know, what's decent and
mm-hmm.
what isn't. Especially, I mean, well, there's the West Coast, but especially North and South. When I looked at the 1952 map, and I saw, you know, most, it's Northeast and
mm-hmm.
then Midwestern metropolitan
Chicago
areas.
Chicago mainly.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
but then there's this little dip into,
mm-hmm.
well, Florida, if you can,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
So were the conversations any different on a regional basis?
That's such a good and important question. At SCMS, I don't know if you went to that panel, but there was a woman who presented on Nat King Cole's show and why it got canceled, and it got canceled because it was